MediTalk with Dr. Ross Walker.
And it's a Tuesday afternoon. Dr. Ross Walker joins me on the phone. Hello, Ross.
Hi, g'day, mate. Lovely to talk to you.
How are you?
Oh, I'm very well, thank you. Very well indeed.
Fighting fit, as they say. Ah, we're getting there, Ross. We're getting there. Some days are diamonds and some days are stone, as they say, Ross.
That was a song, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. I think it was. I've got a couple of questions, a couple of listener questions for you.
Yep.
This comes from Gareth. And when I read this question, I thought, good question, Gareth. I've thought this myself. Dr. Ross, Gareth says, with vitamins and mineral tablets that you take, can you take them together? In other words, he said, if I take 10, 12 tablets a day of different vitamins and minerals, supplements, etc., but can I combine these tablets so that I may take two or three together rather than needing to take one, then another one, then another one, then another one, then another one?
Can I make a confession?
What?
I take about 40 in the morning and 10 in the evening, all together.
You take 40 tablets in the morning?
Around 40. My wife looks down and goes, you're not taking that, are you, that amount? I go, yeah. And there's a good reason for each one, but that's about what I do. There's no interaction. There's no reason to stagger it. And look, can I make the point here to everyone listening? I talk about the 80-10-10 rule. 80% of anyone's management has nothing to do with damn doctors. We're not that powerful. It's how you look after yourself. It's the five keys of being healthy. It's no addictions, good quality sleep, good quality eating and less of it, 3 to 5 hours of exercise, and most importantly, Brent, is happiness.
Yes, let's all be happy.
That's 80%. 10% is pharmaceutical drugs if you need them. 10% is supplements. So I don't think that my 40 supplements in the morning or my 10 in the evening is the key to my good health. The key to my good health is practicing those five keys of being healthy, which I do every day. So that's 80%, 10% of supplements, 10% pharmaceuticals.
So those supplements, you can, if you want, mix them all together. It doesn't matter whether you take this one with that one or that one with this one. It's not going to do you any harm.
Absolutely. And as some conservative doctors will say, all vitamins do is give you expensive urine, and I completely agree, because what you don't need, you will urinate out.
Right.
But what they also do is give you valuable, expensive blood if you need to. So your body's very discerning. Oh, I don't need that stuff, so out it goes through the urine or in the feces or in your breath. So that's the way to do it.
40 tablets? Can I ask you, how many glasses of water do you consume when you take 40 tablets?
I usually swallow 6 pills at a time.
Right.
So I don't have a, some people say, oh, that pill's far too big. It doesn't worry me. But other people, doesn't worry them. It doesn't worry me. So I'd have a good solid glass. And I don't swallow them in water. I'd be sick if I took vitamins in water. So I put some juice in the bottom of a glass, and I just add all these. I take a few powders as well. I mix the powders in. Yeah, it's a big concoction, but it actually works for me.
Okay. There you go, Gareth. Go for your life. Take as many as you like and mix them together. And,
look, a lot of my colleagues will be horrified by this conversation, by the way, because I'll say, oh, it's going to damage your kidneys, it's going to do all this sort of stuff. Well, I had my 67th birthday on Sunday, Brent.
Did you really?
Yes, I did. I've got a 0 calcium score. I've got a PSA that's almost undetectable. My father died of bowel cancer. I've had 4 colonoscopies. I've got nothing at all in the colon. So, and I've never smoked a cigarette in my life, of course. So I've got nothing in my lungs. So I'm pretty healthy for a man of my age, and do 16 Ks on my bike every day.
Well, happy birthday for Sunday. And I know that you won't agree with me here, but I would suggest one of the main ingredients that we can put down to your great health, and you look fantastic. It's certainly got to be all that Pinot you drink.
Look, and anyone listening, 80-year trial from a little place in America hardly known called Harvard, called the Grant Study, showed the one key to health and happiness is to have someone else in your life who loves and cares for you, who you love and care for. And in a few weeks' time, my wife and I will celebrate our 46th wedding anniversary. So there you go.
I'm not far behind you.
There you go. That's the way to do it.
It is the way to do it. I agree with you. Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Kylie says, I'm starting to look after my health a little bit more, trying to lose a bit of weight and regain some fitness levels. Good for you, Kylie. She said, I know diet plays a large role in this process. In my research, I've seen a lot of people removing garlic and onion from their diets.
Yep.
She said, does this actually make a difference?
Look, garlic and onion are tremendously good prebiotics. So basically they feed fiber that good bacteria love to live off. But tragically, there are some people who have a problem in their gut, and we've all, or most people have heard of the low FODMAP diets.
That's it, yeah.
So, yeah, and getting rid of garlic and onion from your diet is part of these FODMAPs, because in some people, the garlic and onion can really irritate the gut and increase malabsorption, increase diarrhea, do a whole lot of other things. So tragically, if you're somebody who has that problem, taking garlic and onion out can fix those people. But again, for most of us, garlic and onion is incredibly good for our health.
So, in this situation for Kylie, would garlic and onion be making it more difficult for her to lose weight, maintain her weight?
I doubt it, because garlic and onion typically feed the healthy probiotics we have in our gut, or healthy bacteria we have in our gut. And as you know, Brent, my favourite gut bacteria, everyone should have a favourite gut bacteria, of course, my favourite gut bacteria is Akkermansia mucinophilia, which only lives in the colons of thin people. It does not live in the colons of overweight people. And so therefore, it's not going to help. Getting rid of garlic and onion, which promotes Akkermansia in the gut, is not going to make people lose weight, no.
Look, we've got more questions. Maybe we'll come back to them if we have time, but this seems like a nice segue to go from that to why do people gain weight? And I've always thought that, you know, possibly excess weight has got something to do if you're living a healthy lifestyle and for some reason you just can't get rid of those extra kilos. I thought it may have had something to do with your genes.
No, not really. I mean, there's a whole lot of different reasons why people put on weight as they get older. But a key thing here is really we take in more calories than we burn off. That's the major thing. There are other things that I will discuss next week when I'll be talking about epigenetics and what that means in regard to weight gain and weight loss. But really, when we get over 50, I sent you an article I think I wrote on BMI. Now, BMI is body mass index, which is your weight divided by your height in meter squared. So the weight in kilos by the height in meter squared. And people see the BMI as the benchmark for where you should be. And the normal BMI where we should all be aiming for is allegedly 20 to 25, as opposed to a BMI from 25 to 30, which is considered overweight. 30 to 35 is grade 1 obesity. Excuse me, I've got a frog in the throat. 35 to 40 is grade 2 obesity. Above 40 is morbid obesity. But listen to this one. Studies recently come out of the U.S., and this was a huge study of people across many nationalities. 500,000 people followed for 20 years showed that, looking at BMI, if your BMI is between 20 to 25, considered normal, when you compare that with somebody 25 to 27.4, so low grade being overweight, those people had a 5% reduction in death rate compared with the normal BMI. The BMI from 27.5 to 29.9, which is moderately overweight, just before obesity, wait for this, 7% reduction in death rate compared with normal with the normal BMI. And this is for people over the age of 50. And what I'm saying is, as you get a bit older, to have a little bit of fat around the belly is no great shakes. But you still want to keep your waist circumference below 95. And I think we should get rid of BMI as an indication. I think we should be looking at things like relative fat mass, because you see, BMI, if you go to the first grade footballers, and I've got to congratulate the people of the Newcastle district for beating the Storm the other day, I thought that was fantastic. But if you look at the first grade footballers, they all have a high BMI because they have such a big muscle mass.
Right.
So they would be 90 to 100 to 120 kilos, but a lot of that's just pure muscle. So what I say is we should now be measuring relative fat mass. So you've got a pen, write this down. Relative fat mass is 64 minus, now that you've got to do these sums, 20 times your height in centimetres divided by your waist circumference in centimetres. And that's your relative fat mass for a male. You want that to be less than 25%. For a female, you want it to be 64 minus the 20 times the height divided by your waist circumference. And then you add 12 to that, and you want your relative fat mass to be less than 35%.
So let's go through that again, because I know there are people that take notes.
Yeah.
64.
Minus.
Minus.
Then 20 times your height in centimetres divided by your waist circumference in centimetres.
And if you're a female, you add 12.
You add 12 to that, yeah. Okay. That's called your relative fat mass, and I think that's a much better indication of total body fat, because no one wants to lose muscle. People just want to lose fat, and the best place to lose fat is obviously off your belly. And the best way to do that is 80% food, 20% exercise, cut back calories, carbs, and grog. That's what puts on the fat around the belly.
Yeah.
And that's 80%. So if you go for a brisk half-an-hour walk, mate, you burn 300 calories. If you have a small piece of chocolate cake, there's 300 calories.
That's the depressing thing about it, isn't it? I mean, you think about what you do each and every morning. I go for a brisk walk, and you come home, and you have your bowl of porridge, and you think, I've just put it all back on.
Unfortunately, that's the case. And look at all those cyclists. I don't know about in Newcastle, but in Sydney, they always end up in the pastry shop after their 50K cycle.
Yes, with a what is it, a double macchiato or whatever they call themselves.
That's it.
Dear. So what determines whether we become overweight or not? That?
I think mainly it's that, but also there are some epigenetic factors, which I'll discuss next week, and there are some genetic factors as well. Let me make the point as well. 30% of Caucasians, 50% of Asians, and close to 100% of people are born with the gene for insulin resistance. So or if you look at people, so South Pacific Islanders, of course, they're very bulky, and that's because they're severely insulin resistant. So when you expose anyone with the insulin resistance gene to Western crap, that's when all the problems start.
Okay.
So I saw a man just before lunch who's just finishing off a stress test with me, and he was a first grade footballer, really, really lovely, very disciplined man, but he's got the gene for insulin resistance, and despite doing all the right things, his hemoglobin A1C, which is 3 month sugar control, is just creeping up, and that's just lousy genes.
Right. And there's nothing you can do about that.
Well, there's nothing you can do about the genes, but there's a lot you can do about the effects of the genes, and that's where doctors step in and give you appropriate pharmaceuticals, appropriate supplements. But still, 80% is how you look after yourself. And the people who do the 80-10-10 properly in my practice, they're the people that become long-term mates of mine.
Okay, major depressive disorder, which is MDD, is a complex and debilitating mental illness. Now, there's a study out. This was done by the Korean University, College of Medicine. It highlights a new biomarker for this major depressive disorder.
Can I tell you what, mate?
Mm-hmm.
You're doing my next week's show. These are all the topics for next week.
Oh, are they?
Yeah, I've sent you the wrong thing. I apologise for that.
Never mind.
So we're talking about all this stuff next week. So I haven't absolutely prepared all that stuff. So today, I'll tell you what we're talking about. today, I wanted to talk to you about a genetic mutation that this thing called the ACTA2 mutation,
right,
which has been found to explain why younger people have heart disease.
Right.
And so when you hear of say, a 35, 40-year-old who ends up having a heart attack, I still believe 90% of heart disease is due to insulin resistance, which I just mentioned, and also the gene for lipoprotein little a, which I've been talking about for years, causes 1 in 5 cases. But there are some people still that stump doctors and they can't find out what the problem is. So they found this new gene, and they found that despite the fact that they might have totally normal cholesterols, that still the statin drugs that we've been speaking about for years actually do affect their long-term prognosis. So I think this is a topic I've had for the future of medicine, is that what happens is that we're now getting closer to understanding why people have their disease, and I've been saying for years, you treat the why. Once you treat the why, everything then falls into place, because a lot of people aren't treating the why, and they never actually affecting the cause of the disease. And something else I wanted to talk about today is Ozempic in a pill. So, you know the Ozempic we've spoken about, the injectable thing once a week that helps people lose weight?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's a drug called a GLP-1 agonist, but it's a weekly injection. And because a big study came out in the New England Journal of Medicine a couple of years ago showing about a 15 to 20 kilo weight loss in people who weren't diabetic who had the injection, the sales of this went nuts over the world, and they ran out of the cartridges to give the Ozempic. So all the diabetics who really needed it, not just to help them lose weight, but also to help them control their diabetes, were saying, well, how come the overweight people without diabetes can get this and we can't? Mm-hmm. So the company who made all this stuff have now made an oral version of this Ozempic, and they've tested it to see whether it also helps you lose weight. And they found that doses of 25 and especially 50 milligrams a day of this Ozempic can help you lose probably 5 to 10 kilos over the time that you take the stuff. So we're moving towards people not needing to have the more expensive injection once a week to just being able to take oral pills.
Can I jump in and ask a quick question? With this Ozempic, it's not just, I'm just thinking here, if you just think that you can continue to, if you've got a lousy diet, right, and you're overweight because you're lazy and you've got a lousy diet, by taking this pill once a week or taking the injection, but we're talking about the pill here, 25 to 50 milligram pill, will you still lose weight?
Look, I don't think you will. I see the problem is with any of these things, whilst you're on the treatment, you will lose weight acutely. But then if you don't change your habits, it'll just reaccumulate, especially if you stop the pill, you just go back to where you were. It's a bit like a diet. I wrote a book 20 years ago called Diets Don't Work. Diets don't work because you go on a diet like you go on a holiday. What happens if you go on a holiday? You come home. What happens if you go on a diet? You stop. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you stop, you just put back flab on again. So and you often lose water and muscle in the first month or so of a diet, not a lot of fat, because it takes a while to get the ingrained fat to start moving. And then by the time you get sick of being on the diet, you've gone back to your old eating habits. And people who diet are spectacularly unsuccessful. So I think really the only thing that does work is having a lifelong commitment to being healthy, which means having a lifelong commitment to eating good quality food and less of it, and having regular exercise. And that's I mean, I know doctors carry on about this all the time, but it really does work if you do it. And if you don't do it, then you're in trouble.
You see, I gave up the grog for 4 months, didn't have a drink, and I thought, well, everyone says, oh, I gave up grog and I lost 10 kilos. And I didn't lose any weight, but...
Yeah, but hang on, yeah, but you don't need to lose weight, for goodness sake, mate. You're like a greyhound.
Yeah. Once was like a greyhound. That was a long time ago. Well, probably not that long ago, really, but anyway. What's next, Dr. Ross, would you like to talk about?
What's next is, and this is a really interesting subject out of Texas, where they looked at the amount of cocaine and alcohol issues in the U.S. Now, you know what the population of the U.S. is, don't you?
350-something million?
Exactly. Well, they're estimating that 50 million of the population either have an issue with alcohol or with cocaine or with other drugs.
Right.
And a lot of people... You see, this is what really irritates me. A lot of people call these things recreational drugs. Mm-hmm. They're not recreational drugs. They're illegal poisons. So with the difference with alcohol is there is a safe level of alcohol consumption. In my view, if you speak to the Canadian Medical Association, they'll say it's 2 drinks a week. A bunch of wowsers over there, I can tell you. I think a safe level is less than 3 standard drinks a day most days of the week, and I think it's always good to have 1 day a week off just to prove to yourself you can.
Mm-hmm.
But there is no safe level of illegal drugs. So people say, oh, I just have a joint once a week. Do you know that within 2 hours of smoking marijuana, you increase your risk for a heart attack by 5 times?
Goodness.
So when people say to me, marijuana's harmless, oh yeah, really? Because the THC really irritates the lining of arteries. But people who use cocaine or ecstasy or anything like that, this study has shown that it actually rots the brain. So it just punches holes in the brain tissue and in areas of the brain that affect what they're talking about, cognitive flexibility, which really determines your academic performance, your employment success, your transitioning into adulthood. And a lot of young people, I think, oh, I'm bulletproof, I'm in my late teens, early 20s, I can do what I like and I'll changed my habits in my 30s. Often you cause yourself so many issues in those age groups by these illegal drugs that you're not as good in your 30s or 40s or ever again by doing it. And this study is just reinforcing that, which is really quite disturbing.
Our time is almost up. Let me just ask you one quick question from Doug. Doug says, I've started to see some decline in my mum's ability to remember certain things, and she's becoming more forgetful. Are there any exercises I can do?
There's exercises your mother can do. It's called exercise. And in fact, exercise is probably the most powerful tool we have against preventing dementia. So people that have 3 to 5 hours a week of exercise, just by doing that, there's about a 30% reduction in progression to dementia. There are some supplements that do help. There's a drink called Suvenade, which some people take, which can help there as well. But again, the guy called Dale Bresden wrote a book, The End of Alzheimer's Disease, where he looked at four features of this program, the MEND program that he's running, which showed reversal in a number of people who are on the program. Number one is lifestyle change. So you keep your lifestyle as tight as possible with all the five keys I just spoke about before. That works for Alzheimer's as well. Number two is all the nutraceuticals, the supplements that help. Things like B group vitamins. There's a new thing out that's a revved up version of folic acid. I can't mention the product on air, but that works very well. Number three is brain training. So people who are bilingual, play a musical instrument, crosswords, Sudokus, brain training, etc. And number four, there's a new technique out there. I'm not sure it's available in Newcastle. I know it's available in Sydney. It's called transcranial brain stimulation. And that's all part of his program to reverse cognitive impairment and dementia.
I've got to go. It's always good to talk to you. We'll catch up with you again.
And
same time next week. And you don't need to send me anything next week.
Okay,
see you, mate. Bye, Ross.